from NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And mis amigos, la vida es una lucha. Life is a struggle. Today, we're throwing ourselves into the thick of it.
I remember as a kid earning some extra money myself, working next to migrant farm workers. And I came away with this deep appreciation for how hard they worked.
One Microsoft executive on the fight for immigration reform. And
you have a stem cell transplant and it seems like you're a different person.
Robbie Rosa of Menudo opens up about cancer, alternative therapy, and the struggle with showbiz.
My first experience was, you know, de la cancha to Radio City Music Hall 10 nights, you know.
We're fighting the good fight with all that and more, so stick around, no se vayan. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today, La Lucha. You might have heard about luchadores, the masked Mexican wrestlers. Later on in the show, we'll hear from a luchador who is taking on homophobia inside the ring and out. But La Lucha signifies more than a fight. It also means the struggle. And in the fight for immigration reform, Los Tigres del Norte have come out roaring. Roaring with words and accordions. This past week saw marches as Latino organizations across the country gathered in Washington and elsewhere to rekindle the push for immigration reform. But it's not just Latinos who are hoping the government shutdown ends and Congress gets back to work on immigration reform. The business community, and in particular, the tech sector, wants to see legislation too. We asked one of the most powerful people in tech to talk to us about why he cares about immigrants and immigration reform. And in this surprisingly candid talk, reveals why this reform matters to the tech industry and to everyone else too. Brad Smith is a vice president at Microsoft. He spoke to Congress about how immigration reform would affect the tech community. Welcome to Latino USA, Brad.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So, Brad, when I first met you a couple of years ago, I met you at an event for immigrant children needing lawyers to represent them. And we can talk about that in a little bit. But I remember asking you, as somebody who grew up in Appleton, Wisconsin, used to be one of the whitest places in America, what was your interest in the whole conversation around immigration in our country?
Well, I think my eyes were first opened to the immigration situation growing up as a kid in Wisconsin. Even though it was, as you mentioned, one of the whitest areas in the country, it was also an area, like many in the country, where migrant farm workers would come at certain points in the year. And I remember as a kid earning some extra money myself, working next to migrant farm workers. Many of them were from Mexico. And I came away with this deep appreciation for how hard they worked. I will always remember coming home at the end of a day where I had been on my hands and knees. It was literally picking onions and putting them in a bushel basket. And describing to my parents how hard the people, in some cases, you know, kids next to me were working. And my mother pointed out that when their day was done, they didn't have as nice a bedroom to sleep in as I did. And that always stuck with me.
So, Brad, make the connection between what you experienced as a young person in Appleton, Wisconsin, to then being at this corporate level and talking about immigration.
Well, we at Microsoft have long been passionate about immigration issues, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is we are a company of immigrants. Even in the United States, a third of our employees have come from other countries. I think that gives us a deep appreciation and maybe even in some ways some unique insight into just the value of bringing together people from around the world.
Do you believe, Brad, that we are in fact at a historical juncture in terms of the conversation around immigration reform regarding the business community and its involvement in immigration reform?
Certainly 2013 has been a watershed year. The business community has become more energized on immigration reform than ever before. If you talk to companies or individuals in the tech sector, most of them will rank it as the single most important issue that will be decided in Washington, D.C. in the coming year. One of the reasons for that is we face a shortage of talented computer scientists and engineers coming out of U.S. universities, especially with U.S. passports. And we recognize that the entire industry's growth prospects and leadership is really very much dependent on being able to bring more greatly talented people to work with us here in the United States.
You're also aware, though, Brad, that there is among immigration activists, people who are saying, you know what, we've got, you know, 12 to 10 million undocumented immigrants. Many of them are unskilled. And now you've got these powerful companies and suddenly all everybody cares about is these higher skilled workers. What do you say in response?
Certainly we at Microsoft have been very strongly supportive of comprehensive immigration reform. And that is not something that's new in 2013. We believe that the 10 to 12 million people in this country who currently are undocumented are in fact a national economic asset. We need people who understand Latin America. We need people who speak the languages that are spoken in other parts of the world. Our future national prosperity turns on our ability to connect with, understand, build products for, and sell and service the other 96% of the world. We need people who can help us do that. And this group, this broad group, is actually an asset that we should all recognize in the United States is going to help all of us in every state in the union.
Take away the numbers argument. What about the humanitarian argument and what motivates you in that part of the conversation around immigration for you?
Well, it never fails to move me to see kids who end up in the United States separated from their parents, who are trying to navigate their way through the country's immigration system. There are about, at this point, over 15,000 of these kids every year in the immigration system. It's a challenge for an adult to navigate, but imagine being a kid and trying to go through it. And the basic view we have through Kids in Need of Defense is that especially if people are here alone, if they're here without a father or a mother, they need a lawyer. They should get the benefit of a lawyer. They should get the help of someone who can understand their case and put forward the best possible argument that exists for them to remain legally in this country. And that's what we've been working to do.
And what do you do, Brad, when you think about the fact that there may be 15,000 kids without parents, who are essentially alone in our country? And I know that I'm asking you to kind of open up your heart, and you are a numbers guy and you are a lawyer, but what goes on for you inside your heart when you think about where these kids are, you know, sleeping or living in our country right now?
Yeah, it's easy to look at the numbers and think of this as a quantitative exercise, but the reality is that for the individuals who are affected, it affects individuals one person at a time. And everybody who finds themselves in this situation, frankly, has an amazing story. I'm amazed by the courage, the hardship that it has taken for them just to get to the United States. For some of these kids, especially those who've fled violent situations in Central America, especially for, say, young women, teenage girls who've had to flee situations where they've faced violence, they have faced horrifying conditions in terms of sexual exploitation. What they've had to go through to become an American, potentially, is far more than most people have ever had to endure in the history of our country. They deserve every bit of help that we can provide to them when it comes to ensuring they get a great lawyer. And to me, what's really heartwarming is to meet a number of them who worked with a lawyer who cared about them, succeeded in making it possible for them to stay in this country legally, in many instances, put them on the path to a green card. And you really see people who have put together really great lives. They've learned from the horrifying experiences that they had, but they really bring to their future a determination that they won't have to deal with that experience again, but even more importantly, the people around them won't either. These are great members of a community. They are great citizens. They make our country better. And I just think it's important for us to continue to recognize that and do something about it.
And yet I'm sure, Brad, that you've heard people say, you know what? Those are the hordes of people, brown people, that are invading our country and they are draining our system, and we need to build that wall and we need to stop this flood. And when you hear people, maybe within your own community, who have that interpretation of what's going on, what do you say to them?
Well, I think the most important thing we can all remind ourselves is how a diverse population makes us all better. It makes us a better country. It makes us a better people. It makes this a better world, a more richer life for all of us. Somebody who gets to come to work and work with people from so many different countries, it makes me better. I may have grown up as a middle income white person in the middle of the country, but I get to see every day how I get to learn new things because I get to interact with people who've come from other places. And I just hope that people can step back from time to time and think about that for themselves. This is an opportunity. It's an opportunity for every person to live in a country that I think is going to have a brighter future if we make more room for more people who have a terrific spirit about them, a terrific commitment, who have frankly endured far more hardship than a great many Americans ever had and hopefully ever will. They make us all better.
Brad Smith, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Okay, thank you.
Brad Smith is an executive vice president and general counsel at Microsoft. And for an extended interview, go to our website at latinousa.org. Which U.S. newspaper in Spanish has been around for 100 years and calls itself El Campeón de los Hispanos, the champion for Latinos?
We don't care if someone else does it. What matters is that we did it, that we did it right. Not only did we win awards, but we actually forced state and city agencies to dedicate funds, you know, to addressing that issue.
Struggling and staying alive with Spanish language newspapers, that's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. As talks on immigration stall in Congress, deportations continue nonstop, no matter what the administration says. According to the Washington Post, roughly 1,100 people are deported every single day. At this rate, the Obama administration will soon reach 2 million deportations since 2009, and the most of any president in history.
I've seen families be torn apart, and that terror that our communities feel by being threatened by deportations cannot continue. We really need to find a more permanent solution for this community.
That's Adriana Sanchez at an immigration rally in New York City on October 5th. Reform advocates are now upping the ante nationwide. 8 members of Congress were arrested last Tuesday at a rally on the National Mall, while others, including some Dreamers, immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, have been taking extreme steps.
You know, our whole lives really depend on this movement, on this action.
Israel Rodriguez Rubio is part of a group that calls itself the Dream 30. On September 30th, they were detained for crossing the border without papers in an act of civil disobedience. Rodriguez spoke to us from the San Antonio Processing Center about what pushed him to participate.
What we're focusing on is reuniting our families and you know, our communities that have been separated and have been dispersed throughout the world. And we really want to bring attention to that, you know.
Some within the immigrant rights movement, though, criticize the Dreamers' actions as misdirected. David Leopold is the former president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
What I don't support is absolutely thumbing your nose at the government, especially when it comes to the sanctity of the border. It makes so much more sense to march on Washington, march on John Boehner's office. Don't let him off the hook.
But for many, the cost of inaction is too high to wait for Congress. California Governor Jerry Brown signed the Trust Act on October 5th, limiting collaboration between local police and immigration authorities.
Currently, the proposals we have seen in Congress right now do not end that collaboration, and they further entrench it.
Gabriela Flora is an organizer for the American Friends Service Committee in Colorado. The state was the first to repeal an Arizona-style Show Me Your Papers law in 2012. Next up, the fight for a Colorado Trust Act.
While the Senate bill has some very positive aspects to it, its continuation and expansion of police-ICE collaboration and its increase in significant number of the enforcement policies mean that we must work for reform and we must work at the same time to stop this collaboration. And right now, at the state levels, is a place where we can have impact.
We understand that Congress has something to do in this debate, but we're not waiting for Congress to act.
That's Pablo Alvarado, who's the executive director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network. They're organizing family members of detainees to sit in at ICE detention centers in the weeks ahead.
President Obama cannot be a bystander in the debate because at the end of the day, it's not John Boehner who is deporting. It's actually President Obama who's doing it. That's why an immediate relief from him would make so much sense. And for us, that constitutes Plan A, not Plan B.
So while immigration reform may appear dead, the immigration reform lucha is alive and kicking. So have you been a part of it? Tell us about it, tweet us, or send us your photos at Latino USA. And now a little bit more on Congress and the media. The government shutdown is certainly a fight, and it's a complicated one at that. I mean, how can you make sense of so much chaos? Some people turn to TV commentators who are supposed to lay out the facts and help us sort through them. For this week's News or Noise, our regular feature on news literacy, producer Daisy Rosario spoke to students about where talking heads fit into their news diet.
Sometimes when you turn on the news, it seems like everyone is yelling. What happened today in the House?
We're defunding. You're not overturning it.
Defunding, delaying what? No, but the thing is, everybody keeps saying it's the law. Laws are overturned all the time. I'm not saying that we're trying to overturn it right
now.
You
tried to overturn it. You went to the Supreme Court to overturn it.
Let me finish. Let me finish.
If that's the way it feels, you've probably turned on a talking heads show. The news and information shows where a moderator leads guests through a conversation, or what should be a conversation, about current events. All that noise can be off-putting, but more than that, it can be confusing. Take the government shutdown. You might feel like Illinois high school student Juan Jara.
I understand that the government's shut down, and I understand that it's because they can't agree on something like the Congress, and after that it just gets kind of blurry, like exactly who is disagreeing, exactly what are they disagreeing about, and exactly what are they trying to fix.
And this teenager values being informed, because
I think you'll be more aware of the consequences of your actions and the consequences of other people's actions and how they affect one another.
So who are these people talking and sometimes shouting over each other on TV?
Well, some of them are journalists. Some of them are ex-politicians.
Actual representatives.
Authors.
People who have written books.
Reverends.
People who have worked in, like, state departments.
They might be experts in something very specific.
Industry experts.
And sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're just yellers.
The students I spoke with understand feeling overwhelmed by the noise. They even have tips for what you should look out for when watching these shows. But it won't be easy. Here's high school student Samantha Votsky of Tampa, Florida.
You have to do a lot if you really want to find something that's going to explain to you exactly what you want to know. Look for buzzwords and try and stay away from them.
Not sure what she means? College student Anam Big can explain further.
So what you have to look for is basically like the type of adjectives people use, the types of sentences, like what kind of statements are they saying? Are they declarative? For example, is someone making a general assumption about a group of people? Is someone using hyperbole, for example? Fluff up, you know, whatever they're saying.
So if you know how to take in what they're saying, is that where you begin?
I would absolutely not go to these shows first. Basically, I feel like when you watch these shows, the assumption is you already know what's going on.
The students all agreed that these shows are your last stop. Alicia Fieldstadt, a college student studying journalism, laid out how to follow a story.
If you hear something that you didn't know had happened, go and read about it. Go Google it and read up or listen to the radio and get more that way. And then, after you've done your research, then turn on one of the pundit shows. Hear what they have to say.
And once you're checking out the talking heads,
then turn on another one on the opposite side and hear what they have to say. You need to change the channel. If you're not going to learn about something different, if you're listening to what you already know over and over and all day long. If you were on a jury and you only listened to the prosecution and then you left, you wouldn't be able to make any sort of informed decision. It's the same thing.
There's one last place you should check if you really want to get a sense of how something might affect you where you live.
Local news, because local news, a lot of times, they bring it back. They localize it. They say, this is how it's affecting people in Tampa, or this is how it's affecting people in Chicago, or this is how it's affecting people in San Diego.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
So tell us, mi queridos listeners, how do you go about feeling informed? Tweet us at latinousa.org. And now for the news in Spanish. A lot of people think Spanish language newspapers are a new phenomenon. But the Spanish language newspaper in the U.S., El Mississippi, started in New Orleans just 5 years after the Louisiana Purchase in 1808. And even as most of the U.S. newspaper industry is shrinking, new Spanish language papers are starting up, and they're thriving. For a glimpse into the world of Spanish language papers, we spoke to Rosana Rosado. She's the publisher of New York's El Diario La Prensa, which this year celebrates 100 years of existence. So we met around 1987, when you were the metropolitan editor of El Diario La Prensa. You had decided, this newspaper, El Diario La Prensa, had decided to essentially get in the face of Mayor Koch every single day. Describe what was happening at the paper and why you decided to do what you did back in the late 1980s?
Well, that was under the leadership of Manuel de Dios, who was the editor at the time. He was my mentor, you know, in the newsroom. At the time, Manuel felt really strongly that El Diario's role beyond the coverage of news was to give voice to a disenfranchised community. And he took very seriously, you know, the slogan that is El Campeón de los Hispanos, you know, that you had to champion the cause. And so he faced off with Koch and city officials over a lot of issues. And when you think about email, you know, he would have photographers take pictures of an abandoned lot, publish it in the paper, clip it from the paper, attach it to a letter, send it by mail to some city sanitation commissioner, wait for action, and then report back on it.
Right, because every day there was a picture. And what was the caption?
It was called Nos Preocupa.
Nos Preocupa. We worry about this. Mm-hmm. And people could send in photographs or make a call and say, look, there's an empty lot, there's an abandoned car.
There's a pothole.
There are people selling drugs,
which was that became very popular because people were afraid, you know, to report it to the police.
But they trusted El Diario. So you're celebrating the centennial of the paper, which is dated from the founding of La Prensa in 1913. The paper actually became El Diario La Prensa 50 years later in 1963 when the two dailies merged. And this happened in the middle of the civil rights era. So when you think about the history of El Diario over the past 100 years and what it's become, yes, tremendous progress, but
still the same problems?
I don't know. Do you think so?
Well, I think they're different. There has been great progress, right? There are more Latino journalists in mainstream media than there were then. There are people at commissioner levels. There are people in elected office. There are people kind of in all the different boardrooms and tables where they have to be, where there was zero. But how we translate those numbers into kind of real equity, you know, real empowerment, I believe is still a challenge.
So you were just at Columbia University, which is acquiring your paper's photographic archive. Is there one story that you just said, oh my God, I can't believe we covered this?
During the Vietnam War, many families subscribed to El Diario for their relatives who were in Vietnam. So El Diario was delivered by mail to Vietnam.
Wow.
And when you think about all these soldiers, both from here, from New York, but also from Puerto Rico, you know, who didn't speak English, this was their reading material. And it also became a vehicle by which families sent messages to their loved ones. And that was a total, you know, surprise to me, something I didn't know and something that really hit me, you know, in the sense of how much El Diario has also been a source of keeping people together, keeping families together.
Wow. El Diario has broken some major stories. I'm thinking about the stories that you guys owned about the 9/11 workers, the Latinos, the undocumented workers. Mm-hmm. Are you proud or is there a part of you that says, well, we broke those stories, but then we still never saw it in the New York Times or we still never saw it on, you know, a major network?
We don't care if someone else does it. What matters is that we did it right. Not only did we win awards, but we actually forced city council hearings on it and forced state and city agencies to dedicate funds, you know, to addressing that issue. We were leading mainstream journalists in the coverage of police brutality back in the 80s when nobody went, you know, I remember going when I went to work at Channel 11 after I left El Diario, I had colleagues who were from Long Island who didn't understand the concept of police brutality. Like, really, that doesn't happen in this country. Like, we don't have political prisoners and we don't have police brutality. And so El Diario was leading in a moment where people didn't even believe that stuff was true. I mean, that's different today, right? And that's different today because of the work we did.
Rosana, you studied in English. You got your degrees in English. You made a choice to work in Spanish language media, and then you left and you worked in English language television, and then you made a choice to go back to Spanish language media again. Why? Why is there this commitment that you have to Spanish language media?
When I went to El Diario and I went as a young, you know, reporter to El Diario and I discovered people from all of these countries with whom I had some type of connection, right? We spoke Spanish, we had similar backgrounds, but we were from completely different countries. It pulled at my heartstrings in some way. It made me feel part of something big. And when I chose to come back, I had an opportunity to come back and be editor of El Diario. And by then, Manuel de Dios had been shot and killed. He has the distinction of being like the first Latino journalist murdered in New York City as a result of the things he was writing about, which was the drug gangs and the drug organization in Queens and in Washington Heights. You know, there are moments in your life where you have like this unique opportunity. For me, it was a unique opportunity to practice journalism at a management level, but to also try to fill the shoes of my mentor, which, you know, was kind of too good to pass up. I took an extreme cut in pay to come back to El Diario, but I knew in my heart that it was the job I would do for free.
Manuel de Dios was the editor-in-chief of El Diario La Prensa, and he ends up being killed in 1992. And yet many people in the mainstream media probably have never heard of Manuel de Dios, even though he was murdered for his reporting right here in New York City. It's strange to think that he isn't more well known because of what he did, you know, dying a hero in his country.
It was fascinating to us, those of us who knew him, that he wound up on the cover of every major paper. I mean, it was a big national, international story. But also, right after his death, a bunch of us journalists, Latino journalists, Juan Gonzalez, myself, we all came together and we had to do a little bit of activism with the police department around the investigation of his murder because, you know, they didn't know him. They didn't know the paper really well. And so they started to, you know, kind of write about his character. And you didn't have to walk two blocks before you found someone who could say, you know, what a son of a bitch he was. You know, I mean, he was, you know, he was one of those controversial figures. But we had to keep the focus in the investigation on this is a journalist who was killed. Manuel did not carry a gun. All he did for a living most of his life was write. And, you know, that was a very traumatic moment for me personally. It took me about a year to get over his death because it was really scary to think that what we were doing, we're doing at the risk of our lives.
When you think about the demographics of the Latino population 100 years ago to now in New York City, it's a totally different Latino population in so many ways. It used to be predominantly Puerto Rican. El Diario was in many ways considered a Puerto Rican.
Especially in the 50s and 60s, it was.
Very Puerto Rican newspaper. And now you have Mexicanos, you have Dominicans, you have Colombianos, Ecuadorians. How has that changed the kind of journalism that you have to practice?
You know what? I love that about El Diario most of all is that there's nowhere else in the country. I want to say there's nowhere else in the world where we have the diversity among Latinos that we have in New York City. And that contingent that is Latin America. We always throw in the Spaniards, you know, out of respect. So we throw in the 21 countries. When you add to that the contingent of people like us, well, me, I was born and raised here, my kids born and raised here, who still wrap their whole identity in that of, you know, their ancestors. That whole that is Latino really exists uniquely in New York City. And we exist as this Latino people here in New York City. I think that's it's just really, really special.
Rosana Rosado, publisher of El Diario La Prensa, which is celebrating its 100-year anniversary. We thank you so much for joining us
thank
on Latino
you.
USA. It's really been great to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Let us know what you think about Spanish language media. Tweet us or Facebook us at Latino USA. Coming up, you know this song. Upside, inside out. She's living la vida loca. She'll push and pull you down. Living la vida loca. But there's a lot you don't know about the guy who wrote it. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Perla negra, cerrada en las manos.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. You might take your drinking water for granted, but in California, it's a lot more complicated, especially when you live in a poor rural town. From public radio station KQED, reporter Alice Daniel takes us to one place in California's Central Valley where the residents are fighting, luchando, for their water rights.
Welcome to Lanier, California. It's a tiny rural town of 600, smack dab in the middle of miles of dusty farmland. There are no streetlights here, no sidewalks, no sewer system. There is a community center, and tonight, many locals are here dancing and eating.
I make a salad, and my friend make beans, and I make beans, so yes, you know, everybody help.
Isabel Solorio is the president of a local group that holds fundraisers twice a year to support the community center. They're also pushing for clean drinking water, something else Lanier doesn't have. Like many unincorporated communities here in California's Central Valley, there are few services and little infrastructure.
It was a lot of labor camps, they call them, you know.
That's Carrie Bonner, still tall and strong after 89 years.
People keep a bunch of people and they do the work, the cotton chopping and the picking and cutting grapes. So whatever season it was, that's what they would do.
She says Lanier was once a series of shacks for African-American farm workers. Her father-in-law ran a juke joint not far from here and was a labor contractor.
When I first came here, it wasn't very many Spanish people here. I think about three Spanish families when I came to Lanier. But as time went on, you know, it switched around. Now it's just a few black and more Spanish, you know.
In the 1970s, a Quaker organization called Self-Help Enterprises worked with the people of Lanier to build houses and put in water lines. But the residents stopped drinking the tap water years ago because it has high levels of naturally occurring arsenic. Then in 2002, says community advocate Veronica Garibay, the town got some grant money to fix things.
County allocated it, $1.3 million.
The town used the money to build a water treatment facility in 2006. But there was trouble from the start. First, there were no water meters, so no one knew how much water was being used. On top of that, some of the clean, drinkable water was being siphoned off to irrigate fields. Most of all, says Garibay, the local people in charge lacked financial and technical expertise.
A board of five volunteers from the community without any background in water operation or maintenance are running a treatment plant.
The state shut down the treatment plant after just 6 months, and now the town's water lines are managed by a private company. Residents still pay a monthly water bill and use their water for washing. But on top of that, they spend $20 to $30 each month for bottled water for drinking. Carrie Bonner recently met with her neighbors outside the community center to talk about their plight.
The water is really good for nothing. You have to buy all your water to cook with and to drink. So it's really expensive.
One of Bonner's younger neighbors, 79-year-old Lela Carbajal, laments it even more.
Everybody cry for the water here. We need water.
Literally, they cry for the water?
Everybody cry for the water.
Recently, the state gave Lanier water meters and a grant to look into the best solutions. The town could consolidate with nearby Riverdale, which is building its own treatment plant for arsenic. And now that Lanier has meters, it could rehab its own plant. Back at the community center, Isabel Solorio says she knows the town is poor and treating tainted water is pricey. But still, they keep trying.
It's a lot of work, but you know what? I am so happy when I see part of my community here and tell everybody, come on, let's go working together because this is your community.
We don't have much, she says, but at least we have each other. For Latino USA, I'm Alice Daniel in Lanier, California.
And if you live in the Fresno area, do join us on October 16th for a community forum to discuss water, development, and representation. For more information, visit our website, latinousa.org. Our community forums are always a great experience, so join us on October 16th in Fresno, California, to talk about water. Robbie Draco Rosas spent a lot of time in Latino music, from his days as a part of Menudo to helping launch Ricky Martin's career another Menudo alum, with pop hits like Living La Vida Loca. Just last year, Ravi Rosa had his own lucha, his own battle with cancer, and he's in remission now for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He's been nominated for 3 Latin Grammy Awards and is touring now in support of his album, Vida, Life.
How are you?
Such an honor, not only for everything that you've done in the world of music, but for having this amazing survivor story. I mean, what an inspiration.
I'm so grateful, so thankful. It's very different. I'm getting to know myself and know everything around me. You know, you have a stem cell transplant and it seems like you're a different person.
So you decide, actually, you say, okay, I'm going to make my last album. In a way, was it kind of that, like, not giving up, but just like, look, the reality is I may not make it out of this. And so I'm going to record an album with all my all-time favorite friends who happen to be megastars, in your case.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. The album prior to this one, which was called Amor Vincit Omnia, El Amor Todo Lo Vence, I actually thought that at one point that was my last album. The idea of doing this duets album wasn't my idea. It was a good friend of mine, a mentor of mine, Angelo Medina, I've known since I was like 14. He has this meeting, and I'm on my way from Brzezinski, unfortunately. People are wonderful, and the medicine, then anti-neoplasm. Problem is I couldn't afford it anymore because, you know, you can't use your,
como se dice, insurance.
Seguro. So then I hook up with these doctors locally, and I start doing this high-dose vitamin
C. In Puerto Rico. Oh, my God.
In the mountains.
Wow. And you had no clue that in Puerto Rico people are doing alternative therapies to
exactly.
treat cancer.
Yeah. Of course, all the doctors are like, oh, he's, you know, you're a fool. You need to go and do chemo. What are you doing? You know, you're going to kill yourself. But I did it up in the mountains, and I did it for several weeks. Between keeping a vegan diet and incorporating the high-dose vitamin C, I was able to eliminate 2 tumors. I mean, they were gone because I had 3 in the abdomen.
Wow. Here you are. You're a musician in your heart. It does, in fact, influence your music. I mean, you can't not survive. And that's why the name of your new album is Vida,
yes.
Life. There are a couple of songs that are a little melancholy. You know, Más y Más with Ricky Martin.
Más y más, si más te quiero, quiéreme, tú mucho más. Más y más.
What about that song? What was, well, obviously you've got an amazing smile on your face just thinking about what, the shooting of that video or...
It was very nice. I mean, I was so excited to, first of all, get out of the hospital, which when I finally am told that I'm in remission December 31st, 2012, I'm told I'm in remission, I go into 3 days of hibernation and depression. I just was stuck in the sofa. I couldn't get out. But once I did get going, the first trip was to New York. And I was so happy to come to New York, so happy to see Ricky. And, you know, we had a good time. And these are things that I was, you know, I never experienced, you know, solo artists. So.
What do you want to say? Más y más vida? More of everything? More joy, more sadness, more pain? It's all la vida?
You know, it's tricky because, you know, a song like Más y Más was written several years back. Same thing with a song like Blanca Mujer with Shakira. I mean, I know you're asking about Más y Más, but when you think about the one with Shakira and we talk about melancholy, you know, that one's a conversation with death.
Por amar demasiado, si quisieras ahora venir y acabar de una vez con mi vida, te lo pido, mi blanca mujer.
I wrote that song and it was like 1994. And I, 1993, when I put my first solo album with Sony, which was called Frio, and I didn't actually put it on the album. I waited till Vagabundo to put it on the album. You know, at that time, I thought I'd die at 27. I was a romantic. You know, as you mature and you realize, you know, this, I couldn't look the other way. Prior to all this, I thought I had to really, you know, life was very serious, and it was just, I think, too serious. And I was told, you know, you take it too serious, Draco, you know.
You mean you took life too seriously? So your friends were like, you're too much of an existentialist.
Yeah, and they was like, you need to lighten up, everyone, you know. And I thought, well, you know, I thought I was okay. I thought I had smiled enough and laughed enough and enjoyed myself enough and maybe too much at times. But I get it today, you know, I get. But I always thought that, you know, death was close because it had to be, you know.
está condenado a morir por amar demasiado. Si quisieras ahora...
As one of the founding members of Menudo, tú viviste en carne propia this notion of, like, you know, put you on a stage and you are perfect even though you're a child. You rejected it.
Yeah, I mean, I think initially it was great. I remember, you know, joining the group. My first experience was, you know, De La Cancha to Radio City Music Hall, 10 nights, you know. I was like, well, this is surreal. And then you're at the Grammys giving an award to Michael Jackson's Thriller, right? You're thinking, wow, this is pretty strange. And I think I embraced it and loved it. But then I found myself living it. And thinking, well, this is became sort of disgusting, you know, the whole process, exploitation of it. And I think that when I quit the group, I said, I just want to write songs. So, of course, I became my worst enemy, too, along the way. And I had to have this happen to me to take a pause. And my wife would always say, you need to slow down, you know, it's because I always like plenty of time to sleep when we're dead.
Do you ever think, well, maybe this is the Santos giving back something to me? Because I was motivated by giving, creating, I'm getting a second chance?
Yeah, there's a lot of all of the what you just mentioned, I think. A couple of months ago, I went to the beach with my wife. And, you know, I've surfed in the past, but I was never able to float in the water. Until recently, I started floating. And I found that to be amazing. I said, well, what is that? I think the joy that I have, I feel much lighter. I mean, me siento mucho más liviano. And I generally think that something happened to me in this process that it's been very positive. I enjoy sleeping. I used to not enjoy sleeping. I used to think I have to get up, you know, why do I have to go to sleep? I have to get, you know, things to do, places to go, people to see, you know, I'm alive. I'm so, so grateful. So yeah, love is everything.
And so is la vida. And for us at Latino USA, it's really an honor to have you here. Un gusto verte.
Gracias,
en persona, tan saludable.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Robbie Draco Rosa is on tour now. His new album, Vida, is on sale now. Check out some photos on our website, latinousa.org, and let us know if you have a survivor story. Tweet us or Facebook us. So, my dear listeners, we couldn't have a show about La Lucha without luchadores. Those are the masked wrestlers of Mexico. Today, we're going to them to provide us with a little bit of sabiduría, some words of wisdom. Here's Jasmine Gartz in Mexico.
Here's what you need to know about lucha libre, or Mexican wrestling. Half the fun is on the ring. The other half takes place in the crowd. The audience constantly competes to see who can come up with the most ingenious, hilarious, and anatomically improbable insult. Lucha Libre companies are a lot like traveling circuses. They go around from town to town, setting up a ring, and bring a roster of fighters clad in shiny outfits and typical masks. Today, I'm in the outskirts of Mexico City, in Culhuacán. There's two kinds of fighters, técnicos, or the heroes, and rudos, the villains. Today, the evil fighter, known as Metaleon, is battling against a duo of luchadores who look like they belong more on the set of a Broadway musical than on a lucha libre ring. Dressed in glittering suits, pantyhose, full drag queen makeup, and with a blowout that would put Farrah Fawcett to shame, these fighters are known as Diva Salvaje and Pasión Cristal. They are exóticos, Mexican wrestlers who are openly and quite flamboyantly gay. They've been around since the 40s, although with the passing of time, they've become more sexually explicit. The crowd loves Diva Salvaje, but there are also a lot of pretty homophobic chants that I can't play for you. Let's just say, as I watch the fight, I wonder what on earth would inspire a young gay Mexican man to become an exótico.
Bueno, yo soy originario de Saltillo, Coahuila.
Backstage, before the fight, I caught up with Diva Salvaje. And by backstage, I mean on an abandoned, gutted bus, far away from the rowdy Lucha Libre crowd. Diva, who is now sporting jeans and a t-shirt, was born Julio César in Saltillo, Coahuila. Even as he studied to become a nurse, his passion was watching the fights every week.
Era una de las personas que asistía semana con semana a las luchas.
He says a friend of his had an in with a local luchador, and the rest is history. As Diva Salvaje, he is one of the most famous exóticos in the business. His family loves to go see him fight when he's in town, but his mom refuses.
Porque ella siempre dice,
but he says mom's absence has nothing to do with him flaunting his sexuality on the ring. If she were to see someone hit me, he says, she couldn't bear it. She'd grab the first thing she could find and get in the ring with me. And what about those names he gets called when he steps into the ring? Is Mexico a homophobic country? I ask him.
Yo creo que en la actualidad no creo que siga siendo un país homofóbico.
He says he doesn't think Mexico is a homophobic country anymore.
A mí si no me gritan algo feo, yo estoy sintiendo que no estoy haciendo bien mi trabajo.
And he adds, as a luchador, if he isn't getting the crowd riled up, he isn't doing his job right. Gay luchadores before him, he adds, the legends, names like Pimpinela and Casandro, they had it rough. But they made it okay for the next generation of exóticos. And they gave him some time-honored advice.
Hija dice, tú no debes dejar de ser sencilla, no debes dejar de ser humilde.
You must never stop being simple. You must never stop being humble. Not only in lucha libre, in every profession. For Latino USA, I'm Jasmine Garst in Mexico City.
And that's it for this week's show. We wanted you all to be able to join us in the luchador fun, so check out latinousa.org for our luchador name generator. We're fighting the good fight next week live from Cal State Sacramento, so join us. Check out latinousa.org for details. Our first ever live show at Cal State Sacramento next week. Our program was produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Diana Montaño, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. We had additional engineering this week from Stephanie LeBeau and Brendan Baker. Our intern is Jonathan Wolf. Special thanks this week to Brooke Binkowski, Mike Bullock, and Tilden Bird at KMHA in Newtown, North Dakota, where we recorded the show on site at the local radio station on the Fort Berthold Reservation of the Three Affiliated Tribes. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for Latino USA Live from Cal State, California. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and you can check out my Instagram, Maria_La_Hinojosa. I'll see you there.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, and the California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR.